Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, once again, this week we have to return to what's happening at the Federal Reserve and inflation. We got a report, latest CPI. We'll talk about that. And it would suggest that the Fed should continue raising rates. But the Fed, in this decision this week, says, no, we're going to pause. At the same time, out of the other corner of its mouth, it says, but we're going to raise rates right after this again. Does the data say don't raise rates, or does the data say raise rates? If the latter, why are they not raising rates? Well, you know, the Fed is in a contradictory position. It's between a rock and a hard place. And it's an indication of how neoliberal monetary policy, i.e. central banks, manipulation of money supply and interest rates, is facing major contradictions. Late neoliberalism monetary policy is in the midst of a significant contradiction. Does it raise rates to further dampen inflation? If it does so, it exacerbates the regional banking crisis. You know, we had this problem with the banks here a couple months ago, which is continuing, by the way. That was largely due to the Fed rapid increase of rate increases over the previous year. Is that banking crisis continuing? You betcha, because the Fed is pumping $95 billion every week into the regional banking system, which is experiencing massive deposit outflows still, and the Fed is filling that black hole with $95 billion a week to keep these banks afloat. And looming over the horizon is a bigger crisis that's going to impact these regional banks. It's the commercial real estate industry. Yeah, already we have defaults in the first 4 months of this year, equivalent to 2009. Yeah, so it's coming, and the Fed knows it. And the Fed has decided we're not going to raise interest rates. We're going to see what happens. Hopefully, this thing in the regional banking system will stabilize. The regional banking crisis is causing rates to rise anyway. Yeah, so the Fed doesn't have to raise rates. The private sector rates are rising because of the banking crisis. The banks aren't lending. They're hoarding their money. And in the anticipation of further problems. And that raises interest rates on the private side. See, you got to understand how this works. The Federal Reserve causes, by buying and selling bonds to the private banks, it causes the private banks to have excess reserves to lend or fewer excess reserves to lend. That's what buying and selling bonds does. And if it has fewer excess to lend, I'm talking about the private banks cut their lending. And that means they have less supply to lend, which means they can raise their rates. It's monetary policy 101 here. The Fed provides major incentives to the private banks to lend or not lend, but it's the private banks, when they lend, that creates the money supply. The Fed just provides big incentives to do that. Okay, well, what's happening is the Fed has raised interest rates, which means that the banks are buying more bonds and money is coming out of excess reserves in the private banks, and at least fewer, less supply, so the banks raise their interest rates. But you can't do it much more, even at, you know, Fed rates at 5.5% now, without precipitating a further banking crisis or exacerbating the existing regional banking crisis. That's the decision that the Fed is now focused on, in my belief. You know, and it's assisted by the Fed acknowledging that the regional banking crisis is causing private rates to rise anyway. So let's see if the banking crisis can raise interest rates to further dampen the economy. And maybe we don't have to. We, the Fed, don't have to. Let's see what's happening there, right? And we won't exacerbate the regional banking crisis here by raising rates further. But, you know, we kind of think, this is the Fed think talk here, we kind of think that we're probably going to have to raise rates down the road anyway, two more times here in the rest of the year. That's what the Fed said. Well, that threat of raising rates also causes the private rates to rise. So you got the banking crisis slowing lending, raising rates, and you got the Fed with this strange decision here, you know, very hawkish. We're going to raise rates. We're not going to do it now, but we will do it. Also causing private rates to rise. So interest rates will continue to rise, and they are rising, even though the Fed rate is not rising. The policy rate, the benchmark, we call that, right? So the Fed has decided to shift its focus, its relative focus, from slowing the economy to try to bring down inflation in services, because that's the only place where we have inflation right now, to bring it down, and to focus more on pausing so they don't exacerbate the regional banking crisis and let natural forces in the economy raise rates in the interim. That's pretty much what the Fed is doing. But, you know, you got to understand what this really reflects long term. What this reflects long term is that the Federal Reserve cannot raise interest rates much higher, certainly not more than 6%, if it wants to slow the economy even further. It's a contradiction, right? If it raises rates to slow inflation more, it's going to further exacerbate the banking crisis. If it backs off and does not raise rates, well, it's not going to bring down inflation. See? And the point is that at 5.5%, this is unprecedented. You know, the Fed used to be able to raise rates much higher without precipitating a banking crisis or exacerbating one that exists now. Right? But it can't do that anymore. It can only raise rates up to 5-6%, and it's got to stop, which is what it's doing right now, even though inflation is still largely intractable. Let's look at the inflation numbers and try to understand what's really happening here. I've talked about this many times, but the latest data corroborates what I've been saying for some time. Okay, look at the CPI released earlier this week. What do we see? A 4% inflation, all items over the past year, 4% over the past year. Okay, that's down from about 9% peak last year. But it's kind of misleading to say 4%, because what you've got is energy prices have declined. Well, why have energy prices declined? Because the global economy is slowing fast. That's why. How much have energy prices declined over the past 12 months? Almost by 12%, 11.7%. Gasoline prices, gasoline at the pump, down 19%. Fuel oil, down 37%. Natural gas, 11%. Right? And in the last month, you know, you got big declines in these categories here of 2.6 to 5.6% in 1 month. Okay, so energy prices have come down dramatically here, and food prices have come down a little bit as well. Right? Now, food and energy prices are what we call headline inflation. In other words, everything, all items, is 4% over the year. Right, but if you look at, you know, the composition of inflation, what's declined is the energy prices, food prices a little bit because it's spring and you got harvest coming in, right? And you got goods inflation down, stable here because of the slowing global economy and exports slowing. So goods inflation has been shaken out. Energy prices have been shaken out. That's why you get from the 9% to the 4%, right? All items. But if you look at what's happening with what's called core inflation, in other words, inflation, all items minus food and energy, you've got 5.3%. Core, 5.3%. Mostly, and services, if you look at just the services part of that, right, you got 6.6% of services. The core can be goods and services minus food and energy, right? Goods and services. Well, I said goods were down pretty much stable. So 5.3%, including goods and all services over the past year. But if you look at just services, it's chronically high. It's 6.6%, right? Well, that's pretty high. But the important thing is that hasn't come down in 6 months. It's chronic. It's stuck. Services inflation is stuck in the 5 to 6% or more range. They can't reduce services inflation by having interest rate hikes of only 5.5%. They have to raise it higher in order to do that. But as I said, if they raise rates, I think they have to raise it to like 8%, maybe more, to really precipitate a deep enough recession that you got massive layoffs in the service sector and wages collapse and consumption collapse and therefore prices fall in services. That's what they got to do. And 5.5% is not enough to precipitate, to trip a recession in services. We already have the recession in manufacturing, the goods sector. We already have it in the housing sector, which is part of the goods sector. But housing and manufacturing goods are only 20% of the economy. The economy is 80% services. So they've shaken out with 5.5% rate hikes. They've shaken out the inflation in goods and in energy. But I wouldn't say the Fed 5.5% has done that. I think the slowing global economy has done that more than the Fed action. Fed has contributed to goods inflation retreat and energy inflation retreat. Don't get me wrong. Well, I would say the housing part of the goods and the manufacturing to some extent. But the manufacturing, I think, slowing global demand for manufactured goods. And, of course, the Fed has not brought down the energy prices. Energy companies don't give a damn about Fed rates. They don't borrow from banks. They're so flush with cash, you know, Exxons and so forth. They don't care what interest rates are, right? But they do care what global demand is, and that's weakening because the global recession is deepening. If you look at exports, China's exports are down. Japan is flat. Exports are down, and the economy is in technical recession in Europe. So the major economies of the world, Europe and in Asia, China and Japan, are flat or declining. Well, that's bringing down the cost of global energy, crude oil, and so forth. Right. So that's what's happening here. The Fed is not really succeeded in bringing energy prices down because, as I said, it has little effect on global energy and therefore gasoline prices and so forth, right? It's the global recession that's bringing energy prices down, gasoline, fuel oil, natural gas, whatever, right? Not the Fed. Food prices coming down is mostly seasonal and because of the harvest here. We still see food prices increasing in those areas where U.S. multinational corporations have monopolistic power. Look at bakery goods and so forth, right? Those areas where you have four or five big companies that control. Those prices haven't come down in those areas. Right? Paper prices, still 10% over the past year, right? Bakery products, 10 to 17%. depending on the product over the past year. The rate of increase is slowing from, huge rates of rise, but they haven't really come down. Transport services still double digit, right? Auto insurance double digit. Rents 8%. Well, they're really double digit rents 8% because of, as I said before, this phony way they roll into their estimate of rent hikes. Based upon what they call owner-occupied rent. In other words, 50 million owners of their own home pay themselves rent. Yeah, what nonsense is that? But that's how they get a bigger base to divide the rent increases that occur and therefore average out a lower rate, you see. So rents are still running high, right? Housing prices are beginning to rise again because the supply of homes is so short in the economy. Even though interest rates whack the housing sector, prices are still rising there, are beginning to rise once again. So you see, throughout the economy, if you peel back the onion and look sector to sector, what you see is chronic services. Around 5 to 6%, 6.3% all services. But if you take out energy services, you got all other services 6.6%, right? And it would be even higher if it weren't for certain sectors of services, like airline fares are down 13%, health insurance down 20% over the past year. So within services, there are certain sectors for reasons that have to do with, super high prices that couldn't be sustained, and now they're coming down in those two subsectors of services. It would be even higher if that weren't happening. But you are stuck. The figure is services inflation over the past year, 6.6%. Right? And if you take out energy services, still 6.3%. And that has been chronically stuck for the last 6 months. Despite the Fed raising rates for the last 6 months, they can't shake out services inflation. They've shaken out goods inflation. They, along with the global economy slowing, they've reduced up to now housing prices to some extent. But rents are chronic. What does the Fed Chair Powell say about rents? It's high. Actually, it's 60% of the inflation in services. Oh, rents are high, but they're going to come down when landlords start rolling over their contracts. Well, we'll see. I don't see why. If housing prices remain high, rent follows housing prices to a large extent. Why rent prices won't stay high? Anyway, summarize here. Inflation, if you look at what's been going on, inflation is chronically stuck in at least the 5 to 6%, more like the 6% range. They can't get it down. The Fed, they can't get it down unless they hike prices, interest rates significantly more, 8 to 9%. Look, there's a historical parallel here that's interesting. What happened in 1981? Well, you remember late 70s, 1980, we had about 9% inflation, consumer price inflation, maybe a little more, maybe 10. How high did the Fed raise interest rates to shake out that inflation? The Fed basic rate went to 16%. And yeah, they shook out services and all the other inflation with 16% interest rates, but they also precipitated the worst recession since the Great Depression of the 30s in 81, 82 to do it. Yeah, 16%. You think that the Fed could raise interest rates anywhere near 15% without precipitating a severe collapse of the banking system? No, they can't do that anymore. And the strain in the banking system starts appearing at 5.5%, 6%. And the Fed knows this. It's seeing what's going on. it's caught between the rock and the hard place of the banking system instability and fragility and intractable services inflation at 6%. It's caught between that. Which one can it do? It can't do both. That's why I say capitalist neoliberal monetary policy is facing severe contradictions and is very inefficient. It can't do both anymore. Well, why is that? In other words, yeah, it appears it can't do both. It can't raise rates above 5-6% without precipitating, you know, a banking instability. And by the way, more recession. It can't do that. Well, why can't it do that? Because late neoliberal monetary policy is facing a changed capitalist economy from 1981. What is that change? It's financialization and globalization. Capital, U.S. capital, spread, expanded around the world significantly in the last 40 years. That was what neoliberalism was about. Right, the U.S. capital expanding throughout the world, and it financialized at the same time. What that means is that when the Fed pumps money into the economy like it did in 2008-09 to try to stimulate the economy, a lot of that money goes into the banks. And where does it go from the bank? Does it go to lending to companies that expand and produce goods and services, real things? That means they got to hire people and consumption increases. Is that where the money, the Fed money, goes when they try to stimulate the economy by lowering interest rates to zero as they did in 2009-10? No. Where it's gone, where it went, is into financial asset markets. Stocks and bonds and foreign currency, forex exchange, derivatives of all kinds. A lot of it flowed not into the real economy in the U.S., but it flowed into financial assets, or it flowed offshore to finance this expansion going on, global expansion by capitalism, U.S. capitalism. So it flows offshore, it flows into financial assets, but it doesn't go into the real economy, and therefore real investment kind of stumbles along. It's stagnant or stumbles along. And, you know, that's exactly what we saw in 2010 to 16. The Fed kept interest rates at zero, virtually at zero. Real interest rates were negative, at zero. And what did we get in terms of stimulus of the real GDP and the economy? We got about two-thirds of what's normal coming out of a recession in 2008-09. About two-thirds. In other words, the Fed, by lowering interest rates and keeping it there for years at zero, got a very weak recovery out of it. Well, that tells you that monetary policy is inefficient when you got a recession. It doesn't stimulate the economy like it used to. And conversely, when you see now this inflation we got, it's also inefficient in the sense that trying to pull money out of the economy by raising interest rates can only go so far without precipitating a financial crisis. You see, so both stimulating the economy and trying to slow the economy to take out inflation does not work as well as it used to. And that's because capitalism has changed. Capitalism has become more financialized and globalized. Contradictions between the financial side of the economy and the real side of the economy are intensifying. Well, gee, this sounds like Marx, doesn't it? Well, it is. Yeah, I would say in that sense, not Marx himself, but the idea of contradictions within the economy itself, which you might say neoliberalism is reaching its limits. Neoliberalism economic policy is reaching its limits as the contradictions in the 21st century third decade intensify. And we see this clearly in terms of monetary policy. By the way, we also see it in fiscal policy, in spending. You know, fiscal policy is raising or lowering taxes and raising or lowering government spending. And that's not working so well either. What's the evidence of that? Well, the evidence of that is this massive deficits and debt that have been accumulating. You know, it's last year it reached $31.4 trillion in national debt, which is just the accumulation of annual deficits. And with this latest debt ceiling deal, it's going to $35 trillion in 2 years. Yeah. And I've seen predictions that on this trajectory, it's going to be $53 trillion by the end of the decade. Wow. I mean, can they continue to pay the interest on that? Because the more that the government has to pay interest on all this debt, which is going up because interest rates are going up, right? The less it has for discretionary fiscal policy spending. Oh, and discretionary spending breaks down into two elements. One is defense and war, and the other is all the other discretionary social programs. Well, they're not cutting their defense and war. They're raising it. So all the pressure from this debt rising is being focused on social programs. And that's just beginning. It's going to get worse, much worse here as the debt increases. Well, fiscal policy is broke. They can't use it to stimulate the economy in a recession because the deficit and debt is already so high. And they're not going to significantly cut it when you got inflation, because the majority of it now is war and defense, and they're not going to cut that. So they're between a rock and a hard place on fiscal policy as well. And these two tools, fiscal and monetary policy, you know, in years past in Economics 101, were all about stabilizing the economy. In other words, lowering interest rates, increasing spending on programs for households and consumers to stimulate the economy out of the recession, right? That's what the classic theory is. And then when you have the opposite of an overheated economy, right, you raise interest rates to slow it down and you increase, you cut your social spending or your military spending. You cut your discretionary spending to slow the overheated economy down. Well, they're not so good at stimulating or overheating, controlling the overheating because of the massive deficit. And why do they have massive deficits? Very simple. Just look at the data since 2001. The U.S. has spent $8 trillion on wars. $8 trillion. It's spent $15 trillion on tax cuts. $22 trillion on wars and tax cuts. And the rest is pretty much having to bail out the system, you know, in 2008 and 2009, having to spend the $1 to $2 trillion emergency, and then spending $3 trillion under COVID here to keep a floor on the social collapse. So, you know, add another $4 to $5 trillion on top of that $8 and $15 trillion, you got $28 trillion. And the rest is pretty much price gouging in the health system. You know, the government paying more for Medicare, Medicaid, SHIP for the kids, whatever. And there's your damn deficit and debt. It's that simple. There's no great mystery about it. You can't cut taxes $15 trillion and spend $8 trillion on wars and not have a massive deficit in debt. And that's what we've had. And it's getting worse. Getting worse. The Pentagon budget is already $886 billion, and they're going to be spending here very quickly before the end of the year another $50 billion, because they're $43 billion they allocated in February for the war in Ukraine runs out in July. So watch it. They'll raise another $50 billion to continue their war there. So they're not cutting defense war spending. No, that's going to continue to go up. And the deficit is going to continue to go up. And they're going to try to take it out on the backs of discretionary social programs, you know, education, transportation, cutting food stamps, right? all those programs, they're all earmarked for further austerity, and that was further cuts. So the deficits will continue. The deficits will continue. And what's exacerbating that problem, the deficits and debt rising, continuing to rise, is that the fundamental way the U.S. empire has financed these chronic deficits under neoliberalism, especially the last 20, 25 years, is to have foreign countries who had been flooded with dollars, because the U.S. has run a trade deficit since the early 80s with all these countries around the world. The understanding was this trade deficit, which means dollars flow into the rest of the world. The rest of the world would recycle these dollars back to the U.S. by buying treasury bonds and other investments. Well, that's declining sharply. Yeah, the big recyclers have been China and Japan and Europe, right? And they're all slowing down in terms, especially China, just not buying treasuries, you know, a consequence of the U.S., you know, sticking its thumb in the eye of China here and preparing for war. You know, why should they be caught with more dollars and so forth? Why should they buy more treasury securities when the U.S. would just freeze them like they did $350 billion of Russian security? They just froze it, took it, stole it, right? And the Chinese aren't stupid. They're not going to continue that game. So they're slowing it down. So the money's not coming back. And the money that would be coming back has been used to offset the budget deficit every year. It's been a major force of financing the budget deficit. The trade deficit finances the budget deficit because of this recycling of the dollars. But as the global economy and countries respond to U.S. sanctions by saying, we don't want to hold as many dollars, we want to trade with each other here in our own bilateral currencies, right? Or let's create an alternative, a petrodollar or something, or let's use a basket of goods using the gold and the Chinese yuan for buying and selling between each other. Well, that means a lower use of the dollar, which means fewer dollars being recycled, which means you can't offset the rising budget deficit, which means the national debt continues to accelerate. You see how these things are all connected? You know, they're all connected in the global economy. It's a one world economy now, and the U.S. cannot control it the way it used to. That's the big change that's occurring. You know, you listen to what this past week group of African nations meeting in Kenya had to say, and that is pretty much a large unanimous agreement, let's start trading without using the dollar. Yeah, bad sign. And you got South America, you got Brazil under Lula saying the same thing among South American nations, right? And in Asia, you got the same thing going. Well, the dollar's in deep doo-doo. And it's accelerating pretty fast. The momentum is pretty great to move away from the dollar. Well, moving away from the dollar upsets this whole twin deficit solution to U.S. neoliberalism that I talked about, right? That you got to recycle those dollars if you want to continue to run a large budget deficit, if you want to continue to cut taxes, particularly on investors and corporations, and if you wanted to increase your war spending. This is how the thing has been fueled. Well, the origins of the twin deficit solution to the budget deficit, trade deficit to the budget deficit, lie in the role of the dollar, the dominant hegemonic role of the dollar, and that's under attack. So fiscal policy, which is tax policy, spending policy, and managing debt, right, is also in deep trouble, also facing growing contradictions. You know, but the neocons don't care. Neocons are running foreign policy now for over 20 years. You know, really, the whole neocon thing began impacting U.S. policy under late Clinton. You know, Clinton couldn't keep his damn zipper closed, and everyone went after him, and he pretty much gave anybody what they wanted to back off. You know, he gave the banks deregulation and so forth, for example. But he also brought the neocons, and that's when, you know, 1999, when NATO really started this push east. And that's the real fundamental root of this crisis in the Ukraine war, NATO pushing east. Yeah. And subsequent bringing other Eastern European countries into NATO, I think in 2004 or 2005, whatever, and then trying to destabilize using the small country, Georgia, to attack Russia, which didn't go well for the empire. I think that was around 2008 or 2010, right? And then the 2014 coup carried out by Victoria Nuland, right, who was Under Secretary of State for Eastern Europe, who's a real neocon, right? Also, previously a finance capitalist out of Chicago, by the way. Now, I hear there's an open position in the State Department that Victoria Nuland is the key candidate to fill the number two position right behind Blinken. So you're going to have a rabid neocon running U.S. foreign policy. The problem is foreign policy has been captured by the neocons, and that's why we have this quarter century of constant warfare. The U.S. is running amok using force as its empire weakens, using force here and there and everywhere, and as it tries to expand NATO, which is its vehicle, further into Eastern Europe. In Ukraine, this is the geopolitics, and we'll see what happens with the Ukraine war here next month, because by then it'll be clear whether this Ukraine offensive fails or not. And it looks like it's not going to succeed. It's not going to succeed because neither Ukrainians or Russians have sufficient force to conquer the other. You see. They need much more. You know, Ukraine's have maybe 500,000 men, and now the Russians have, 400,000 at least hunkered down in defensive positions. Ukrainians can't conquer the Russians, and the Russians can't conquer them. You need at least 1 to 2 million men in arms, you know, with all the appropriate weapons, either side, to have a decisive outcome in that conflict. And neither side has that sufficient concentration of forces to be able to prevail. So we're stuck. We're stuck in locked into this situation, both sides. I think Ukraine forces are going to be really gutted in this offensive as they throw themselves against the brick wall of Russian defenses, you know, 2, 3, 4 layers deep. And then in July, NATO meeting in Lithuania is going to have to decide what to do next. You know, are they going to do overtures to see if they can freeze in place the conflict? Or will they double down and try to use more NATO forces and weapons and resources, even Polish troops here on a larger scale? Who knows? Who knows? But there is talk about using tactical nukes. You know, now that's been raised. Neocons are crazy, you know, but that's where they're going. Every time a neocon policy has failed, they get closer to saying, well, we got to use nukes, tactical nukes. Well, anyway, that's a digression on Ukraine, but you can't separate out what's going in the proxy war in Ukraine from U.S. War and defense spending, and you can't separate that from the deficits and the debt and the failure of the twin deficits and the whole contradictions to capitalist, U.S. capitalist fiscal policy, which is over and above the contradictions that we see in monetary policy, as well. Both of these two main levers of stabilizing and expanding the capitalist system are in trouble, I believe. Contradictions are intensifying for both. And these two main tools are not as efficient and therefore not as effective as they used to be. And it will continue. We will see where this goes. But just to summarize, once again, the inflation problem, it's not resolved. It's stuck. Services are stuck at 5 to 6%. They can't get it down unless, I believe, they raise interest rates above 7 to 8%. Then they will really precipitate a major recession that will cause major layoffs in the services sector and bring down wages and income because of the layoffs there. That will bring down services and inflation. By the way, the consensus is pretty large, even among mainstream economists, that this recession is going to deepen. We're already in recession in the goods sector. In other words, manufacturing is contracting now for months. And business activity in certain areas of the country is really in decline. Some sectors, not as much, geographic sectors. But manufacturing is contracting, according to PMI, Purchasing Manager Indexes. Housing has collapsed to two-thirds of what it was, and it seems to be stuck there. So the goods sector is already in a recession, no doubt. The services sector, it hasn't spilled over to the services sector yet, and it won't until they generate massive layoffs in services. But to do that, rates have to go much higher, but they won't. And that's the summary scenario of where we are with inflation. The Fed Chair Powell has always been saying here that they have to get wages down in services. That's the key. We got to attack wages and get it down in services, even though the wage gains have been slowing in services. And if you're at the median and below income levels, you're contracting, right? The slowdown is being slowed. The slowdown is slowing because of, at the very high end, business professionals and so forth, they're still getting wage increases, right? So the Fed is very clear. To really get inflation down, we have to have more wage reduction to get it to 2% prices, the Fed target. We need more wage compression. But they're only going to get that if the recession deepens in the services. And that's their target, service workers' wages. That's their remaining target. They got goods down, goods production down, and they got energy prices down. But they can't get services inflation down. The way to do that is massive layoffs in services, and that's where they're going. But they got to pause in that. The Fed paused in that, right? Because the Fed is more concerned about the regional banking crisis, and because the Fed sees the banking crisis slowing bank lending anyway, and they want to see how much that raises private sector interest rates. The organic development in the real economy that's driving rates higher, without the Fed having to overlay on top of it its moves to raise rates. That's why they think they can pause for a month or so, because they want to see how much the bank lending contraction because of the banking crisis has the impact on raising rates. Naturally, they want to see how much that occurs. But they said if that's not sufficient, we will continue to raise rates here two more times at least. in July and in September. And that's why a lot of economists think that those rate hikes are going to come. And that's why they see it really beginning to impact the economy, the real economy, by the end of the year and deepening the existing recession in goods, in services as well. You know, that's where we're going. More recession at the end of the year. The other excuse mainstream economists have is that, well, you know, the changes in post-COVID in the economy have meant that the normal 9-month lag of interest rate hikes, which should have been bringing down all prices here by now, we're already 15 months into rate hikes by the Fed. They should have been starting to impact the economy after 9 months. Well, they're saying that, post-COVID, you know, it's probably longer than the lag in monetary policy is probably more like 18 months, which means this fall, right? September, October, it'll really start crunching the economy. And the Fed kind of thinks that's what's going to happen. And they want to lower here over the summer, see if what's happening with the regional banking crisis can stabilize a little bit more before they start raising rates again. But if services inflation remains stuck in the 5.5 to 6% range, they will raise prices, interest rates again. They will. And the Fed kind of said that hawkishly, you know. Look, we will raise rates if it's not enough. And I think that they will. But we'll see. It depends to some extent on the banking crisis, regional banking crisis. If it looks like that's been stabilized better by July, August, the Fed won't be so concerned about that. And it will return to focusing primarily on raising rates to reduce services inflation. In other words, precipitate a deeper recession in services before the end of the year. So, you know, it's kind of like a hiatus. We're kind of at a threshold here in terms of monetary policy. In terms of fiscal policy, well, there's no threshold. It just continues to worsen because there's going to spend more and more on war and defense, no doubt about it. And I believe they're going to come at take another swipe at discretionary social programs here around September, October, when the budget, Biden's budget, comes up for debate. Yeah, I mean, they already significantly cut $2.1 trillion, according to McCarthy, in social programs. You know, in this debt ceiling deal, $2.1 trillion, you know, why they raised defense spending. And that's why, you know, you're still going to see the deficit continue to rise. It's not enough. They won't cut more spending. So they got to cut more social programs. And they're going to do it. They're going to take another bite out of that apple here before the year is over. You know, they already did. A big bite. And by the way, I think that bite that they already took is going to get bigger as well, because there's a provision in that debt ceiling deal that says if Congress does not pass all 12 money authorization bills before the end of the year, that the freeze in social spending that was part of the debt ceiling deal becomes a 1% across the board cut in social spending. I think that's going to happen. There will be a cut of 1% in discretionary spending, not defense discretionary, but, you know, social programs discretionary. And then they're going to come and take another bite of the apple in the budget, passing the budget here before the year is over as well. So, contracting fiscal policy on social discretionary spending is in the works as the economy slows already. I mean, you're supposed to stimulate the economy as you're slipping into a recession. No, they're doing just the opposite. So you know, we can expect a serious recession here before the end of the year, much deeper recession here. And depending on what happens with, you know, the regional banking system, we may see more problems there, because by at the end of the year, the commercial real estate market is going to have to roll over and with much higher interest rates. And that means the defaults and bankruptcies that are already rising fast will accelerate even further at that time. So the picture is not all that pretty, you see, for the U.S. economy, regardless of what they say. We could have a much worse banking crisis as commercial real estate flops here, bankruptcies rise. We could have a deeper recession here as interest rates continue to rise and social programs continue to be cut. And if all that happens, of course, then they will shake out the services inflation by next year. But you will have a big problem in terms of recession and a big problem in terms of economic growth at that time. So 2024 could be a very negative economic year for the U.S. At the same time, on the global stage, we see, as I said, this growing momentum away from the dollar. Probably away from the U.S.-dominated international payment system, the SWIFT system, that will accompany it, right? History will show the neocons, who are really dumb, not only politically but economically, shot themselves shot the U.S. in both feet here with these sanctions, which didn't work on Russia, but accelerated the whole move away from the dollar, de-dollarization going on, alternative currencies, the expansion of the BRICS, which is happening here, more bilateral trade without the dollar. All that is accelerating now because of the sanctions. You know, these countries look around and say, hey, you know, the U.S. and its arrogance has stolen $350 billion of Russian assets in Western banks, froze it, took it like a pirate. Well, they can do that to us, too. Looks like the U.S. is on a binge of sanctions binge here. We better move away from the dollar here to protect ourselves. And that's what's happening globally. You know, look around the world. African nations have awakened here and collectively are moving in that direction. Look what's happening in South America. Well, Lula took over in Brazil again, kind of taking the lead there. And you've got all this instability in the Andean nations going on, coups and insurrections and everything, you know, in Peru, Ecuador, and soon Colombia, right? So very destabilized situation in South America and Africa for the empire. Asia is a little bit more mixed, right? But in any event, you look at the global economic empire, it is in decline. It's under great challenges, and the U.S. and the neocons are reacting militarily as they try to expand even among into this weakened situation. Now, history will show the neocons played a big role in the decline of the U.S. empire and U.S. political power in the 21st century. That's how, you know, the global trade and money situation fits into the domestic fiscal monetary policy situation. And the bottom line is, contradictions growing in late neoliberal capitalism in fiscal and monetary relations and policies, contradictions and decline growing in global economic power of the U.S. here. And all this points to continuation of these contradictions and a continuing decline of U.S. hegemonic power, economic and political, around the world. Okay, that's it. I'm out of here today.